Bear with me this morning. I'm kind of choked up with a lot of sinus drainage this morning. But anyway, I'm really excited for us to start a new series on Sunday morning for about the next 12 or 13 weeks. It's a topic that I've been giving a lot of thought and consideration to over the last several months. And I hope that it is beneficial to you, and hope that you get as much out of it as I've got in starting and putting it together. Of course, I'm continuing to work on that as time goes on, as I have time. I want to start off this morning by asking some questions, because this lesson is going to require the participation of everyone. If you can, if you will, to participate. And as we think together, and as we look at this particular topic, and because it all kind of begins and it starts with general things, and we're going to wind up at a specific point that we're going to make some conclusions and draw some inferences from everything that we've studied over the first 10 or 12 weeks. So, you know, I want your participation. I want your mind to be in it, to be thinking about it. So I'm going to start off by asking a few questions, general questions, but they're going to lead to the introduction of my topic. Which first century congregations received report cards from heaven? And what are they? Let's name them.
Thyatira.
Sardis. Philadelphia. Ephesus. Pergamos. Smyrna. One more. Or maybe you said it.
Thyatira.
Laodicea. Glad to see you. And what's the order? Does anyone know the order those are given in the Revelation?
Geographical order.
Okay, I want the order of that the letter exists in the Bible. The first one is what?
Ephesus.
Ephesus. That's in. Now all this is in Revelation chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. So first the letter was written to Ephesus. And then we have the letter to Smyrna, and then the letter to Pergamos, and then the letter to Thyatira, and then we go to Sardis, Philadelphia, and the last one is Laodicea. Okay. Question number two. Of which first century congregations do we have the most information about their establishment? Now, this may be a little subjective, but I think there are two that are probably most prominent. Which of the first century congregations that we read about in the Bible do we have the most information in the Bible about their establishment?
You mean out of these seven?
Pardon me?
You mean out of these seven?
No, in the New Testament. Okay. I've got one of those. Ephesus.
How about
Jerusalem? Now that's the two I picked out. Now the others that you mentioned, yes, we do have, you know, we have information, but just think about Jerusalem. Of course, that's where the church was started. That's where the first big congregation got together. They appointed deacons. Now, it doesn't tell us about them appointing elders, but we know they had elders because we read about the elders later on. We know about all the problems they had and how then they started dividing up after persecution. So we have quite a bit about Jerusalem. Now, what was the primary nationality of the members of Jerusalem's congregation? They were Jewish. Now, Ephesus, on the other hand, what was the primary nationality of the congregation at Ephesus?
Gentile.
Okay. So we have two opposites here in several ways, and they weren't both started at the same time. Of course, Ephesus came a few years later, 20 or so years later, that Ephesus was started. Okay, question number three. Which first century congregation was the recipient of two inspired letters that was addressed to them? I like to see your thinking. That's good. That's what I'm trying to get you to do. Well, yeah, I hadn't really thought about divide. Yeah, the first and second. Yeah, I wasn't thinking very good when I, but not including, and you know, that is true, but not including those like First and Second Corinthians and First and Second Thessalonians and.
Are you talking about positive?
Hmm?
Positive type.
Two letters.
Well, Ephesus got the letter of Ephesians and the letter of Revelation.
Okay, that's what I had in mind. So the answer is Ephesians. Question number four. Of which church in the New Testament do we have the most information? Now, this is kind of subjective, too.
There's quite a bit about the Church of Jerusalem, but there's quite a bit also about Ephesians.
Okay, would you pick one? What would, if you had to pick one, what would you say? And we might pick something different.
Well, I don't know. The Corinthian letter, you know, dealt a lot with problems, and not so much the establishment.
Right.
But more.
And do we know anything about the end of it, or the, you know, do we have a report card for it? To me, that's a big thing.
Well, there is somewhat a report card in 2 Corinthians of the problem they had in 1 Corinthians.
Yeah.
So on that one issue.
On that one issue, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You still haven't come up with the one I'm looking for. Bill?
If I understand your question correctly, the book, the letter to the Ephesians gives you a great deal of information about the church, and particularly when you get into the fourth chapter, different parts of the members and such. The one thing about Ephesians, when you look at the book of Acts, and you see, you look at the letter to them, and then you look at the letter of Revelation, what happened to them over that period of time? It wasn't very long.
Okay, you got the point I'm looking for. To me, it's Ephesians. Ephesians. I mean, I'm not saying we have the most, I maybe should have clarified, not the most words written about these churches, but the most complete history. And I probably should have formed the question like that. The most complete history of a church. And I believe that, and arguably, I mean, you know, we could say other churches, but I believe that Ephesus would qualify in my mind for that. Now, I've given you four questions. What has been the prominent word that we use through those four questions? That was related in all four questions.
Information?
No, just a word. Just a, well, a church, I guess. That's what I'm looking for. What church was more predominant in those four questions? Ephesus. So anyway, that kind of introduces my what we're going to study about. We're going to do a study on the Church of Ephesus, or the Ephesian Church. And you know, it's going to be a fairly comprehensive study, but yet it's not going to be an exhaustive study at all. But I think that by looking at the church at Ephesus from its beginning all the way to its ending, as far as we know of it in the Bible, I think that there's going to be some good lessons that we can learn from the church at Ephesus. And, you know, what does Romans 15 and 4 say? What about things written aforetime? Were written for what? Our learning. You'll have to speak a little louder. My hearing aids, I've got to go in this week and have them checked. They're not very good. For our learning, when we talk about written before time, what do we usually think about that verse? What do we usually refer to?
The Old Testament.
Is there any, do you think it also refers to the New Testament? To us today? I think it does, doesn't it? Just as equally, it, you know, I mean, basically that's what we're looking at, studying the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it's for our learning. So the purpose of this study is to guide us today, guide the congregations today. And I think each congregation should think about this by studying the influence, attitudes, and consequences of the Ephesian church as described in the Bible. Now, let's just, in getting started, this is going to be totally introductory today, so it may be more of a lecture, but feel free to jump in and give a comment or a question anytime. What is influence? What is influence? An act of causing something to happen. The effect of one thing or person on another. Influence can be a factor that tends to have an effect on molding and shaping who we are and what we do. Now, what is an attitude? Is it a mental state? Isn't it a mental state involving beliefs, feelings, and values, which will affect a person's disposition to act in certain ways? And what about, what is consequence? Well, it's the outcome or results produced by a cause. That is, with a proper attitude, it is reasonable to expect a good outcome. And with a improper attitude or a bad attitude, it's reasonable to expect a bad outcome. You know, all people are influenced by their social, geographical, and spiritual environment, which has an effect on their moral and religious disposition or attitudes, which invariably leads to certain consequences. Now, we've already said this, but this was in my notes that I had started putting together. Which congregation in the New Testament is most outstanding in regard to its scriptural accountability? Well, I believe that there's probably more scriptural accountability information on the Ephesian congregation than any other, because it is based on Paul's letter to Ephesus and his letter to the evangelist Timothy, who worked with the church, and its report card letter recorded in John the second, or by John in Revelations 2. Now I'm going to write down on the board what scriptures will we be considering in our study when we're studying Ephesus. Which scriptures? Well, I'm going to write these down. Now, it doesn't mean we're going to go verse by verse through all of these books and chapters and things, but we're going to scan over them and pick out what we think would be an influence on the church at Ephesus, and what would be influencing their attitudes, which would bring about the consequences that we see when we look at chapter 2 of Revelation. First, we're going to look at Acts. Chapters 18 through 20. And then we're going to look at 1 Corinthians, chapters 15 and 16. And then we're going to look at 2 Corinthians, chapter 1. And then, of course, we're going to look at the book of Ephesians. And we're going to look at 1 and 2 Timothy. And we're going to look at 1, 2, and 3 John. And then we're going to look at Revelation chapter 2. So if you want to, jot those down, if you want to kind of study and go along with us and try to help me in coming up with the influence that we think that the church at Ephesus had upon it, upon its formation, upon its progress, upon its problems, then you can be reading these chapters, because we have Acts is, of course, where it was. We find where it was established. In 2 Corinthians, or 1 and 2 Corinthians, we have just a little bit mentioned about it. Not very much. Maybe just a verse or two or three in there. Then the whole book of Ephesians, we're going to look at the whole book. We're going to scan it. We're not going to go verse by verse, but we're going to look through. And I've got 1 and 2 Timothy. Now, the reason I've got that in is because we feel like that Paul had left. We know Paul had left Timothy at Ephesus to work with the church there, and we feel that he wrote these two books to Timothy while he was there. So some of those things that he said should have been also taught to the church at Ephesus. Now, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, the one reason, some scholars believe that John wrote these three epistles from Ephesus in A.D. 97, making it shortly before he died. Now, others assign the date of writing to A.D. 68, which was shortly before the destruction of Jerusalem. And it was about this time when we find that John wrote the Gospel of John, according to history. But let's just look at some internal evidence that might suggest the later writing of 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John in Ephesus, after he had received the revelation from God. After he had written Revelations, then he wrote 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John as his last message. You know, I've talked a lot about last messages. I can see a last message in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. But, you know, it appears that 1st, 2nd, 3rd John were written primarily to Gentiles. And if you want to just turn into 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John somewhere there, I'm going to be quoting a verse or two if you want to look. But these were probably primarily written to Gentiles, because in 1 John 5 and 21, he specifically says, "Keep yourselves from idols." And that sounds more like he was writing to Gentiles. Also, we need to consider that there's very little reference in those three letters to the Old Testament. Also, the use of the terms such as little children and beloved, that may indicate a very close association with those to whom he is writing. And this could also suggest that those three letters were written by a very aged writer. Now, with no mention of his name, there's no mention of John's name in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. So with no mention of his name, it suggests the author assumes the readers are acquainted with him. And as we look through those three letters, the predominant principle of love throughout John's epistles appears to apply to the problem that existed at Ephesus, according to the Lord's letter written by John in Revelation chapter 2. However, if we look at, you might say, well, look at John, 1 John, the second chapter, verse 18. It suggests the time of the writing could have been before the destruction of Jerusalem. But regardless, you know, of when or where John's epistles were written, they contain some very good admonition in regard to Christian love. And since that, we know, was the main problem in their report card, then we're going to look through 1st, 2nd, 3rd John just to pick up some thoughts that may have influenced the church at Ephesus. Now, what are we looking for in this study? So here's where you have to all help me. As we go through these different scriptures that we're going through, there, if you see something in there that you think, oh, that could have been an influence on them, good or bad, then, you know, make a mental note of that. And you'll be able to do that better mentally than I. I mean, I come up with these, but I forget them very easily, so I have to write them down. But I want you to help me, because first we're going to look at the evidence from the Bible. I mean, and I say that first, I mean, that's foremost. That's what we're going to base our study and our conclusions on. It's the evidence from the Bible of facts, doctrine, that influenced the establishment and conduct of the congregation at Ephesus. And then we're also going to consider some selected historical facts concerning other religious and cultural influences that may have affected the attitudes and consequences of the church at Ephesus. Now, that's what I want to look at and spend the rest of the time this morning, is looking at how does the social religious status of Jerusalem, as that mainly Jewish city and congregation, and Ephesus, which is mainly Gentile, how does that compare during the first century? Well, I'm just going to briefly go over some of these thoughts and just lay them out for you to think about. The religious social situation in Jerusalem was a very exciting and tumultuous time in the first century, primarily because of the displacement of the old law with the new law. That was very disturbing for the Jewish people. And I can understand, and we would have been very disturbed also. But you know, the first century started with a lot of excitement, and it was around a little baby boy that was born in Bethlehem. But it ended with the destruction of Jerusalem, which in effect removed the remaining remnants of the Old Testament religion. However, that babe in Bethlehem, and by the way, I think we believe that that's that small stone that was carved out of the mountain of the Roman Empire. That babe in Bethlehem rapidly grew into a new religion that overwhelmed the world. Now, next, let's just review some important Jewish Christian happenings during the first century, just very briefly. First, there was the period of organization. This began with BC 3, the birth of John and Jesus. Now, these dates are not precise, but understand we have people say different dates, but 3 BC, the birth of John and Jesus. AD 10, Jesus visits the temple. AD 28, John's ministry begins. AD 29, Jesus is baptized. AD 31, John is beheaded by Herod Antipas. And then we find that this period of organization continues in Jerusalem. In AD 32, he sent out 70 disciples were sent out. That 70 kind of goes along with Bob's lesson on Wednesday night, that 70 elders. But in this case, it was 70 disciples were sent out. AD 33, Christ was crucified. AD 33, this church was established. AD 36, Stephen was martyred. And in AD 36 also, then we find that Jewish prosecution of the church really took off and really ignited. And of course, it scattered the church. So in this, then we have a period of transition. AD 37 approximately, we find that Paul was converted, and that led to the next period of, which was a period of expansion, that begins with Paul's missionary journeys. Paul was really the one that got in there and stirred things up and started going out and taking the gospel to all the world. So during this period of expansion, AD 45, Paul's first missionary journey, AD 50, we have a meeting in Jerusalem concerning circumcision and some other matters that all the leaders gathered there and come up with some decisions. Then AD 51, Paul's second journey, and also it was during that year that Paul's first visit, or it may have been shortly thereafter, but maybe 52, Paul made his first visit to Ephesus with the introduction of Christianity to that city. And then in AD 54, Paul's third journey. In AD 55 and 56 and 57, Paul spent about 3 years at Ephesus. And then later on in AD 57, Paul meets with the Ephesian elders at Miletus. And that's the last time we know that he was physically visiting any of the members of at least from Ephesus. Maybe he visited some of them. Maybe some came to him. But then during this period of expansion, I think it's really interesting to note that after Paul's visit to Ephesus, he wrote several of his letters that have some influence on the church at Ephesus. In AD 57, he wrote the first letter to the Corinthian church. In AD 58, he wrote his first letter to Timothy. Also in AD 58, he wrote the second letter to Corinth. In AD 60, Paul's voyage to Rome. AD 61, Paul's letter to Ephesus. AD 65, Paul's second letter to Timothy. Now, I know I'm reading those very quickly, and if you want to go back over these, Jay's recording this. You can go and listen to the tape if you want to go through these and think on those or write them down. And then finally, we find that opposition to Christianity shifts from the Jewish persecution to Gentile persecution. It was under the power of the civil Roman Empire. And we find that in AD 66, Paul was martyred at Rome. AD 68, the Roman persecution of the church really intensifies. In AD 70, Jerusalem was destroyed. And then we don't have too much in between, but then around AD 95 is when John wrote the book of Revelations. So it was during this latter period of about 40 years, we would call those the formative years of the young church at Ephesus. And this segues right into, let's take a brief look, at a comparative look at the social religious status in respect to the city of Ephesus. Now, we just got through looking at about the city of Jerusalem and Christianity and mainly the Jews. Now let's focus on the city of Ephesus and see what kind of influences there would be there. I'll quickly read through this. During the first century, the religious social situation in Ephesus was in turmoil. They had been conquered and controlled by the Roman Empire, and then to have their world turned upside down by Christianity. All this was very disturbing to them. You know, much of the early history of Ephesus is shrouded in legend and mythology. And much of the early history of Ephesus, let me read from the book. I have a book. It's called Ephesus and the Temple of Diana. It was written by Edward Faulkner back in the 1800s. And I'm just going to read a few quotes from him about Ephesus. And I think it really sheds some light on the moral and spiritual influences in Ephesus during the first century that may have influenced the Ephesian church. So let's consider some brief quotes on the mythological background of Ephesus. And I'm going to start quoting. The foundation of Ephesus dates back to the birth of Diana. Diana and Apollo were born in the territory of Ephesus. And the city would appear to have been dedicated to Diana in the most remote antiquity. Now, as far as the origin of the city, he said it has been ascribed to Croesus, a native of Asia, and to Ephesus, who was thought to have been a son of the river Chester. So this is mythology. This is it's talking about the gods. And one was a son of the river Chester, and they called him Ephesus. And that one became the namesake of the city. However, another story is told that the original founders, finding difficulty in the selection of a place for to found their city, and fearing to commit an error, they went to consult the oracle, which was supposed to be the reference, which declared that a fish would show them and a wild boar conduct them. And the common belief is that some fishermen were preparing a dinner of fish. And when one of the fish jumped from the fire with a hot coal in its mouth and fell among some dry stubble, it ignited the fire in a thicket, in which, by chance, a wild boar was concealed, which, frightened by the heat, ran along the mountain and fell as being transfixed by a javelin in the place where the temple of Minerva now stands. It's mythology. Historians record that very early in the city's history, a temple was erected to Diana, and another to the Pythian Apollo. In fact, most of the history of the city of Ephesus is associated with the Temple of Diana in one predominant way or another. Here's a very interesting statement by Faulkner in his book, which I wanted to include this because it tells us a lot about Asia and Ephesus in particular. He said, "This region of Asia is abundant and fruitful with all good things. It has various wines, oil, barley, purple, and good wheat. No climate in the world is more temperate than that of Asia. No country more fertile or better stored with wealthy and pleasant cities. And the time of its inhabitants is chiefly occupied in festivals and sports." Okay, that gives us an influence, doesn't it? You know, it's said that the city of Ephesus was the originator of the culture of liberal arts. You know, the study of mathematics and physical and science and those type of things. It has been supposed that the use of these, and which also included magical arts of sorcery. And it's been supposed that the use of these arts exhibited the secrets of nature with the appearance of giving men supernatural powers, which they ascribe to their various gods. We find many practice these arts in Asia, deceiving the gullible multitudes and profiting by their expectations. So, you know what? This really sets up an interesting confrontation between the miracles of Paul and the magical arts of the sorcerers, which we're going to be considering when we look at the 19th chapter of Acts. Therefore, when Paul arrived in Ephesus in AD 51, the worship of Diana and the magical arts of sorcery had been a huge influence on the citizenry of Ephesus for centuries before Paul came to preach Christianity. Finally, just a quick comparative look at the status of Christianity in Ephesus. You know, being the capital of the Roman province of Asia and its chief seaport, Ephesus was probably the most important city the Apostle Paul visited, save possibly Rome. The residents of Ephesus were generally Greek, and their religion was polytheistic idolatry. However, in AD 51, there was a fairly large community of Jews living in Ephesus, as attested by the presence of a synagogue. So as you can see, when Christianity was introduced by Paul, he was in fact initiating the beginning of the final decisive battle to destroy the major weapon of Satan, being idolatry, against the Old and New Testament of the true God. But thanks to God, from that time forward, the influence of the ancient form of idolatry was rendered of little effect, especially up until about the 3rd century AD during the time of Constantine. You know, Paul had earlier wanted to go into Asia on his second missionary journey, but the Holy Spirit wouldn't allow him to go. But after starting churches in the cities of Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Athens, and Corinth, he eventually arrived for his first visit at Ephesus in AD 51. However, during that time, Paul could only spend a very short time preaching to the Jews in the synagogue. And upon his departure, Aquila and Priscilla, his fellow Christians who had accompanied him from Corinth to Ephesus, they remained at Ephesus to continue teaching the gospel of Jesus. Then next we find Apollos came. He was an eloquent preacher from Alexandria. When he was more fully instructed by Aquila and Priscilla, because he only knew the baptism of John and not the baptism of Jesus. But anyway, he was instructed. So here we have Apollos being a very strong teacher in Ephesus for a short period of time. And then finally, after he received corrective instruction, he went to Corinth to preach to the people of that city. So when Paul came on his third missionary journey, he came to Ephesus again, and this is when he spent over 2 years, which was probably the longest period that he had spent in any city on his journeys, except maybe Rome while he was in prison. But upon his arrival, he taught 12 men who only knew the baptism of John. And, you know, that I would say that probably they had been influenced by the original teaching of Apollos, and they hadn't been corrected on that. Well, our time is running out, but maybe... I'd like to just kind of finish this. Paul's personal influence on the church at Ephesus involves his teaching in Christianity in the synagogue where he went. Now, this is on the second visit. He went there until he wore out his welcome. And then he moved his ministry to a public hall or a gym where he brought the disciples and he taught them daily for 2 years or so. And the fruit of this ministry was the conversion of many souls throughout Asia. However, as one would expect, the Diana influence stirred up much opposition to Paul's teaching against idols. And this came from the silversmiths union led by Demetrius. They made their living manufacturing statues of Diana and replicas of her temple. Their livelihood was being threatened, so they stirred up a riot, which really endangered Paul's life. But he left Ephesus and he traveled to Macedonia. Then we find a few months later, on his way back to Jerusalem, he stopped at Miletus, and there's where he called for the elders of the Ephesian church to meet him. So they had elders. And I would suppose that Paul ordained those elders during his 2 or 3 years that he stayed in Ephesus. I don't know. It doesn't tell us about that. But Timothy was left at Ephesus for an unknown period and continued to develop Christianity in that region. And finally, it's believed that the Apostle John lived at Ephesus for a time before and after his banishment to Patmos, during which time he wrote the book of Revelation. And, of course, he wrote about the seven churches of Asia. But in conclusion of this introduction, which has been just a fast, rapid lecture, pretty much. But, you know, I believe that all congregations of the Lord's church, including Riverside Road, are represented somewhere within those seven report cards in Revelations. We can find ourselves somewhere in there because there's a whole range of commendations and condemnations. And so that's what I'm wanting us to really focus on, because I'm thinking that Ephesus is probably one of the most representative of churches today. So we'll pick up with that next week, and appreciate your attention. But hopefully, if you can be starting to study these verses in this order, these chapters or books in that order, that's where we're going to begin with next Sunday in our second lesson.